The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
This whole thing about there being some kind of a 5G race, I think, is a mischaracterization. If there is a race, it's a marathon. But it's been played as if it is some kind of a sprint with a finish line. I mean, the United States was not first in 1G, 2G, 3G, or 4G. Yet, the United States is dominant in wireless devices and applications. And I think we need to look at 5G in that kind of construct and not confuse a technical standard with a product market.
I'm Margaret Taylor, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 1st, 2020. I sat down with two of my fellow Brookings scholars, Tom Wheeler and Nicole Turner-Lee, to discuss their new papers published as part of a two-year-long Brookings project called Global China, Assessing China's Growing Role in the World. Links to their papers can be found on the Brookings website and on this episode's show page. We talked about where the United States and China stand in the so-called race to deploy 5G networks, and the need for a coherent U.S. national strategy going forward. We talked about spurring American competition by liberating the crucial asset of the next wave of the digital economy, consumer-generated data. Finally, we talked about the prospects for effective regulation and protection of individual privacy. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Tom Wheeler and Nicole Turner-Lee on 5G deployment and digital competition with China.
So Tom and Nicole, before we get to the substance of your very good papers, I want to start by just orienting our listeners a little bit. I like to do this every time I do a podcast on 5G, because I think a lot of times people talk about 5G and jump into a bunch of jargon, and it's not entirely clear to everyone why it's important. So just for each of you, in 2 minutes or less, describe in your own words what 5G is exactly and why it's going to matter to, for example, a typical American, either now or 5 or 10 years. Nicole, do you want to start?
So I think the question, Margaret, around 5G technology is interesting. I mean, we've always had these iterations from telephone to where we are with mobile technologies over the last few decades. And I think in the case of the generations of mobile technologies, we've seen 1G, 2G, 3G, and most recently, most people who are listening to the podcast have 4G or long-term evolution technologies, or 4G LTE. And 4G LTE essentially has been the technology that's enabled many of the things that we're enjoying right now, which are social media, as well as some level of, in COVID-19, telehealth, et cetera. It has a bandwidth that has the capacity to run simultaneous applications over this particular generation of mobile access. But 5G is going to be more promising. And it's more promising because it's expected to have peak download speeds as high as 20 gigabits per second, and what's considered lower latency, which will allow for more specialized and precise applications, including things like the Internet of Things and sensors, remote medicine, or connected cars, or augmented or virtual reality. So as we look at 5G and why we're actually talking about this, I think in every stage of wireless technology, we've actually advanced further beyond what we were previous. But we also, and I'll close here and let Tom, who's been working on this for most of his career, particularly as the former chairman of the FCC, we're actually, you know, anticipating that 5G will allow for greater specificity that will take us to the next level of mobile wireless use in ways I think that will go beyond just the individualized experience of how long you can download a Netflix movie to things that we can do across enterprise-based applications.
Well, I think that is a great description that Nicole gave. And let me go a little broader. Everybody wants to talk about 5G, but far too often it is misunderstood and misrepresented, and as such is open to manipulation by politicians who want to use it to justify an action they want to take, by companies who want to use it as a marketing tool to gather attention, or in the recent case of the T-Mobile Sprint merger, to justify consolidation. But I think the important thing to recognize is that 5G is a technology. It's a tool. It is not a product. And what makes 5G important, as Nicole said, is what it will enable. You know, the reality of networks is that it is never the primary technology that is transformational, but its secondary impact. And as Nicole said, we saw that in 4G, which gave us the whole app world. 5G is a software-based network, and that design is what gives it the greater speed, the lower latency that Nicole talked about. But this whole thing about there being some kind of a 5G race, I think, is a mischaracterization. If there is a race, it's a marathon. But it's been played as if it is some kind of a sprint with a finish line. I mean, the United States was not first in 1G, 2G, 3G, or 4G. Yet, the United States is dominant in wireless devices and applications. And I think we need to look at 5G in that kind of construct and not confuse a technical standard with a product market.
So let's just then, you know, speak directly to that we haven't said the word China, I don't think, in this podcast yet, but the project in which you two wrote your papers that are being published. It's called Global China, Assessing China's Growing Role in the World. And so that's the context for each of your papers. So talk to me about that competition. Nicole, in your paper, you do characterize, you know, sort of race to 5G. What do you mean by that exactly in your paper?
Yeah, so I think Tom is right in terms of the product race, and in no way am I denying that that exists. But I do think if we look at the history of 5G deployment, that the United States and China are in some type of race, even if it does not have an end finish line. And that race has a lot to do with the timeliness of our policies that support the conditions for the effective deployment of spectrum, which are the invisible airwaves needed to power these mobile networks, the global supply chain, as well as the R&D that's actually invested in 5G applications and products like Tom is suggesting. I think because of the nature of how China is structured with regards to governmental authority, that they have been much more expeditious, primarily because they can. Right. And if you know about China, this use of the term race is not just one for 5G, but it's also in the terms of artificial intelligence. And I do think that this is a serious concern. I don't want to, Margaret and Tom, sort of minimize the conversation by reaching somewhere else. But if we look, for example, at what we're going through right now with COVID-19 and the global supply chain for PPE, and the fact that China has dominated that market to some extent, that we have had to reach out to them for those products and supplies, I do believe that we're going to face a similar type of crisis when it comes to our deployment of a technology that will, in many respects, be defined by the standards, the interoperability, the data security, as well as other logistics that come with, you know, being first. It's no secret that, you know, China has started in ways that could inform the ecology of 5G mobile networks. And so for me, as someone who has been primarily focused on domestic policy and who has visited China through Brookings China Center and had conversations with several scholars, I think it's an important caveat to add to the conversation of 5G deployment. How do you structure a regulatory environment in such a way, particularly United States, so that you can maintain a competitive edge as opposed to sort of not holding on to the type of global leadership that will be asserted once we actually get into this next generation of mobile?
And just to hang on that for a bit, Nicole, your paper, you know, talks about the need to engage stakeholders at all levels, both public and private, federal and local. My question for you is, from your perspective, who's going to be the one to develop that strategy? Is it the Trump administration through regulation? Is it Congress? Is it the private sector? From your perspective in your paper, you know, how does it come about? How does a coordinated plan that incorporates robust and timely spectrum policies, scalable alternatives for 5G equipment, and a long-term R&D spending plan, who does it?
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting because what's happened in the United States to date is that we have a system, unlike the Chinese government, where, you know, democracy matters, right? And local decisions matter. And because of the type of infrastructure that is going to be needed to deploy 5G networks, in particular, small cells, which will move away from just macro cells to hundreds of thousands of small antennas that will need to be placed within local communities. We've actually seen, Margaret, in this debate, sort of a back and forth between local governments and federal governments. And local governments have sort of felt burdened upon, right? They feel like, you know, now we're not just dealing with the siting and zoning around one macro cell. You're now asking us, private sector, to place hundreds of thousands of these cells, you know, depending on the size of our community, it's way more than our bureaucracy is actually ready to handle. And because of some of those bureaucratic hiccups, and again, this is not necessarily because, you know, we're fragmented and just, you know, dysfunctional, but that's just the way we are, right? That the federal government has had to respond to that, and what they've opted to do is to really move forward as a leader on the plan, which is to sort of say, you know, place blanket regulations in terms of the timeliness of approvals of these antenna, as well as, you know, in some cases, sort of preempting local laws. Now, I'm not saying that that's right or wrong, and I'm sure Tom has an opinion about that as well. But I think the key thing is that because we are sort of working from a different inside-out framework than the Chinese, the point of my paper is to say we can stay in this debate and continuously try to figure out who's on top of managing and calibrating these strategies. To the one extent, it's been the Federal Communications Commission through the blanket regulations that expedite siting and permitting. To another extent, it's been the private sector based on the amount of capital they've already invested and the private capital that's not been dependent on the federal government. And then you have the White House, right, who is looking at a whole host of items, and I'm sure we'll get into it in terms of their impressions of foreign companies providing equipment. And so I just think the United States is very disjointed, but not quite dysfunctional. You know what I mean? They just don't have a way to sort of rally all of these areas in a way that's very coherent and plows ahead with an expeditious manner to ensure that, you know, again, the Chinese government are just saying, hey, you can go ahead and do this. Don't worry about the regulatory restrictions. It's okay, you know, getting these permissions that we don't quite have. So again, in my experience watching this debate over the last 10 years, I think we're somewhat better in terms of our position. But I do agree with Tom. We in the United States are running more of a marathon just because of the way that these processes sort of get in the way.
So Tom, before we get to the substance of your paper, which is a different kind of a different tack, putting on your hat as former FCC, how do you see this landscape right now? The things that Nicole is pointing to. What's your sort of broader perspective on kind of where America is vis-a-vis China or other countries on 5G?
Well, I was proud that during our term, we were the first country in the world to make 5G spectrum available. And that spectrum is already being put to work. It's being followed. There's lots more spectrum that is being put out, which is a terrific idea because you can't have the kind of throughput that Nicole was talking about unless you have the bandwidth of broad swaths of spectrum. I think we also have to be concerned that because this is an all software or essentially all software network, we know that software is inherently hackable, and so we know that 5G is also inviting new cyber threats and new cyber challenges. I agree with Nicole that we have had, writ large, a national policy. We've had an absence, if you will, of a national policy. I do worry a bit that on the one point that she talked about in terms of, for instance, antenna siting, that 5G became a convenient excuse to give the companies to use a questionable federal authority to be able to go in and impose the federal government's will on local communities in the name of 5G, and that's an issue that's being fought out in the courts as we speak. But I do think, and you know, to go to my paper, which is, you know, 5G is just a sidelight in that, is that as Nicole says, competition with China is real, and it is important, and we need to move from an environment in which the competition with China is the basis for spin to accomplish whatever your goals may be, to having some kind of a national strategy. And I suggest in the paper that that really ought to be in three parts. That the first part is that we shouldn't let the China threat drive us into being like China with a handful of national champions, big, dominant companies that we look to as being the answer, but that we should be like America and good old-fashioned American innovation-driving competition. You know, China's huge population and the data creation that comes from the various apps that they've been developing gives them a leg up on implementation of the digital future in things like artificial intelligence. We probably can't win on implementation. We've got to win on innovation. That's where the American success story is: entrepreneurial innovation. And therefore, what we need is a national plan that is more than leave it to the big companies, but is a plan that encourages competition and the innovation that flows from that. And the concern that I have, going back to Nicole's point about we don't have a very well-organized structure, is China has said, and it's a matter of national policy, we will be the world's digital leaders in 2030. That should have been our Sputnik moment. You know, when we had Sputnik back when I was a kid, you know, it immediately launched a space program. Where is our national digital program? Where is our Sputnik moment? We don't have it.
So turning squarely to your paper, Tom, you focus on the idea of the essential digital asset being consumer-generated information that is going to a certain number of large companies in the United States. And as I understand your paper, your argument is this is the key asset moving forward, and what the regulatory environment should do is make that digital asset available to a wider number of players so that innovation can occur. Is that a fair reading of your paper?
I think that's a very fair summary of the paper, that the capital asset of the 21st century is data, is digital information. And it is very different from the capital asset of the 19th and 20th century, from industrial assets. First of all, it is inexhaustible. You know, coal was the principal capital asset of the industrial revolution. Data is the capital asset of the information revolution. You use coal and it's gone. You use data again and again and again and again. And every time you use that data, it is iterative in terms of its ability to produce a data that can be used for a new product. So you use data that has been used before. You just go into a file and pull it up. You know, when Facebook wants to add another subscriber, it just uses the same software it's been using before. When Ford wants to produce a new truck, they can't do that. They got to go out and buy all new stuff again. And then the use of that data creates new data itself that can be used to improve the product or to offer new products. So it's inexhaustible. It's iterative. It is also what the economists call non-rivalrous. If I have a lump of coal, you can't have it. I use it. You can't use it. Data, because it is inexhaustible, is non-rivalrous, so that you can use it and I can use it and we can both benefit from it. But the difficulty is it's being hoarded by the dominant companies as a rivalrous asset. So the point I make in the paper is it's time to open that up and to allow that openness of the key asset of the 21st century to drive the innovation that is the secret to how we successfully compete with China.
So before we go on, I have to just ask you, because when I was reading it, the idea of consumer-generated information being the key asset, it makes me literally feel physically uncomfortable. You know, I know that these companies are harvesting information and data on me every time I use, well, I'm not on Facebook, but Twitter or other social media or apps, really. It makes me uncomfortable to think that these companies are collecting information on me. It makes me even more uncomfortable to think about that data being released to, you know, not only a limitless number of even like American companies, but wouldn't the idea you're talking about be also releasing that data to Chinese companies or companies from any other country? Like, can you assuage discomfort with this idea?
Great question. And the answer is no. But let me be specific. You know, what the companies do, I call it digital alchemy. You know, they take something that was yours and mine, our personal information, and they turn it into a corporate asset. Now, what I'm suggesting is that they shouldn't be hoarding it, but they ought to be making it available for other innovators. Not for free, but that they need to open it up. You asked the very appropriate question, which is, okay, when you open it up, how do you protect privacy? And that has been a very important issue. And one of the solutions to that is what's called differential privacy, where you take a database and you add noise, if you will, into it in a manner that does not affect the usage of the data to produce results, but does make sure that nothing can be done to rough that, to compare that data with other data files and thus violate individual privacy. This, for instance, is what the U.S. Census Bureau is doing now. That all this data that they collect on us, they woke up and they realized, oh my goodness, we can compare one data file, which is, quote, anonymized, with another data file, which is, quote, anonymized, and you end up de-anonymizing things. So they're using differential privacy. As I say, it introduces some noise into there, which doesn't affect the ability for the data to be used, but does have a massive effect on the ability to violate privacy.
Okay, Nicole, your thoughts on this question. Assuage my discomfort.
So I actually want to jump in a little bit, and I want to jump in before I have a couple of comments to make on the China issue, and then I want to chime in on the privacy piece and data as a new infrastructure. I mean, I think just on the infrastructure side, just going back to Tom's comment on China, I think you're right, but I think we have to be careful about creating a conversation in the United States where we're still polarizing entities in the development of these 5G networks, because I think that will definitely be a deal breaker in terms of the United States actually making any traction. I mean, this is an all-in conversation when it comes to the prioritization of the next stage of a mobile network that it can encompass all of the product applications that you're discussing. And I think it's just actually a very futile conversation if we actually make this into a political conversation, which is somewhat of what we have seen with the Trump administration as we navigate that. I mean, it's really clear that the United States is not China, and it's very clear that we do not want a nationalized network because that idea was actually tossed. But I also think that, you know, it's to our advantage to be much more coherent about this, because to your point, if data is the new currency, then it has to run off of something. And I think within the absence of strong infrastructure, it's hard to have just a data infrastructure conversation. I mean, I can look at what's happening right now with the coronavirus outbreak and the fact that infrastructure is a real blockage to, you know, millions of people accessing the internet for resources from education to employment to general services, simply because they live in rural areas, they live in areas where there's minimal competition, or they live in areas where they cannot, or they're a person that cannot afford the cost of that infrastructure, or that device, or that application. And as a result, I don't see this as two separate conversations, I guess is my point. But I do think when you talk about privacy, I mean, Margaret, to your sense, there is a level of discomfort in terms of that. And I did read Tom's paper around, you know, the fact that we have to have these conversations to unpack what is really happening, at least on the big tech sector. But again, if we just focus on big tech, we're missing the entire point about the fact that the United States, compared to other countries, does not have federal privacy legislation. And so in the absence of federal privacy legislation, we can throw out technical fixes like differential privacy. But in the work that I do, which is focused on marginalized communities, none of those are foolproof in terms of ensuring that we will not see levels of bias, or we will not have areas creep in that allow people to take what could potentially be anonymized information and re-identify that and place it, you know, in context or what we know of other people who are distinctly different than mainstream populations. So I think we have to have this conversation concurrently on what does the United States think about the privacy of our information? How do we value in terms of our norms and our principles? And what are the guardrails that come in our value statements around what's important in the collection and the use and the repurposing and sharing of our personal data? I'm more interested in that part of it. And I think the companies, to Tom's point, it is correct, need to be better stewards of how they use the information. And we've given way too much control as a result of deregulation in the United States. And if you go back to China, where, you know, the conversations there are different because they collect data for governmental purposes and have a high state of surveillance compared to the United States. So I think, you know, again, I am with you, Margaret. I'm very uncomfortable with navigating through this conversation without comprehensive privacy legislation that offers the correct starts and stops of how our information should be handled.
So, you know, Margaret, one of the reasons that we don't have any privacy rules, when I was chairman of the FCC, we put privacy rules in place on the broadband networks, so that their rules were essentially the same as the privacy rules that exist for our telephone networks and have existed forever for our telephone networks. And 57 days after the Trump administration took over, the networks and the big tech companies like Google and Facebook went to Congress and got Congress to pass a law repealing the simple fact that your broadband network ought to have the same kind of privacy protections as your telephone network. And so, you know, there's a lot of lip service given to, oh, we need privacy legislation. But the track record is when privacy rules are put in place, they are opposed. But I want to talk specifically about Nicole's really good point about the difference that comes in the directed economy of authoritarian capitalism, which is what exists in China. And a centralized structure like that is inherently anti-entrepreneurial. And that is our opportunity. You know, I was meeting with a bunch of folks from China a few months ago, and we were talking about this, and one of them rattled off in Chinese and then translated for me the following phrase: the more you try, the more you fail. And that is it is a trite phrase, apparently, in China, where what it is saying is you are told what you are to develop. And if you go off on a different tangent, you fail and are punished for that, which is about as anti-entrepreneurial as you can get. And remember, what was Thomas Edison's comment? I haven't failed 10,000 times. I've succeeded in finding 10,000 things that didn't work. That's the American success. That's why we have to focus on innovation. And that's why we need the raw material of that innovation, which is data, not to be hoarded by a handful of companies, but to be available for entrepreneurial innovation writ large.
So I think, Tom, I want to respond to you on just when you were chairman. So it's so funny. My colleague and I sit across from each other, but there were times I was often in his office trying to come into Brookings to actually talk about these issues. You know, I wanted to just add on in the privacy piece, though, in terms of what you did under your chairmanship. I think, yes, you were very, had a lot of foresight in terms of this debate coming up. But I do think if you were to fast forward a few years later and for another conversation, we could talk about, you know, where we were from a regulatory policy debate standpoint with net neutrality, like you said, different political regimes in terms of the parties. But I do think what we're seeing now with the internet and the ecology of the internet is much more broader than just telecom companies being regulated. I honestly think as we look at not just telecom companies, but tech companies and banks and, you know, other retail sectors that are now have become tech companies, that it's really important for us as a country to see that each and every one of these actors are in some way touching our data and nonprofits. And so to err on the side of creating a comprehensive framework that values the stewardship of that information, I think is really critical. The EU has already done it. And even in some cases, China, you know, despite the pressure and the authoritarian leadership style they have, you know, in many respects, that's their privacy policy. We're the only country that has not been very clear about really looking at the entire ecology and making the right balance of innovation as well as the protections of consumers. But I also think we need to be careful about data as the only currency. I'm in the process of writing a book for Brookings Press on the digital divide. And I know that's a topic of great interest to you. I mean, not all data is created equal in this country, and not all data is collected equally. So we have to also be careful as we talk about the data currency and the data infrastructure that exists, that we have blind spots. We have people, you know, according to the FCC's latest report, you know, 20 plus million upwards that do not have access to internet or choose not to regularly contribute, which then creates data deserts in communities where we need more information, whether it's around a public health pandemic or it's educational opportunities or just their commercial spending behaviors. And so I think we just need to be careful of looking at it just from a private sector lens, but we need to look at how we democratize access to this information in ways that's both protected as well as equally available so that we can create the type of society that is highly dependent upon this innovation going forward.
So I think that's exactly the point that I was making at the outset, Nicole,
which is
it's never the primary network. It's always the secondary effects. And the fact that somewhere between 21 and 42 million Americans could not get access to high-speed broadband, which, as you say, COVID has shown to be so important, is absolutely deplorable and needs to be addressed. The fact that low-income Americans don't have a structure that is available to make sure that they can file for their unemployment benefits, or they can file their job application, or they can do their homework, is absolutely ridiculous.
It is. It is. And it's one of those things, Mark, you're not taking over your podcast, but I just want to bring this point. At Brookings, the China Center regularly travels to the World Internet Conference in Wuhan, China, not Wuhan. And I always go to this local market that's right outside of the conference center. And I speak no Chinese, but I participate because of my interest in these issues. And there's an older lady who runs that particular market who doesn't speak English, but we communicate via her smartphone and her QR code, where she's able to take my payment if I was connected to WeChat, or she's able to communicate with me the price. And I always tell people, when I look at that experience that I've had over the last few years, and I compare that to some areas in America that are low income or remote, we don't even compare when it comes to the amount of digital access that we are providing in this country. So I think, you know, these may be two different topics, Margaret, but in many respects, they're the same because they lead to the same type of digital competitive.
Let me see if I can. Let me see if I can, Margaret. I hate to walk in here. Let me just. There's
I'm going to get a question in here one of these days.
There's two aspects here. Nicole is absolutely right to say that networks are really important. But back to my point is, it's what the networks deliver. And this conversation is now focusing on networks, which I'm happy to talk about. But what we really ought to be thinking about is the future, which are things that networks deliver, such as machine learning, such as artificial intelligence, because those are going to be the developments that will define the remainder of the 21st century. And the networks are ancillary to that. And so how do we win the competition with China that says we're going to lead the world by 2030 in these kinds of digital activities when our government policy is one of, well, let's just keep hands off, let the big companies do whatever they want, and not have an effort? Here's an interesting thing. Congresswoman Anna Eshoo recently wrote a letter to the president in which she pointed out that the Shanghai government spends more in non-defense artificial intelligence research than the entire federal government of the United States. Now, that's not right.
Yeah, I read that in your paper and was quite struck by that.
And so we need a national plan, which is more than, well, we'll just have a few national champions and we'll go out and do them. So I am a capital C capitalist. And there is a huge difference between authoritative capitalism and marketplace capitalism. But one of the limitations of marketplace capitalism is that you invest for return. And I'm not sure that the future innovation of the United States ought to be tied to the investments for return to their shareholders, decisions that are made by a handful of companies. I'd like to see innovation run wild. I'd like to see this all-American concept of competition drive all kinds of new innovation. And to do that, we have to open up data.
Okay, so I want to just speak directly to the regulations, right? Because I feel like what we're really dancing around is, what is the right level of regulation? What kind of regulations should there be? Tom, in your paper, you talk about how the big tech companies really set up regulation as this like boogeyman that will prevent the United States from being able to compete with China. But what I think the argument you're making is actually effective regulation will enhance competition and allow American ingenuity and innovation to come to the forefront. In my opinion, in our political culture, even like the word regulation is almost like a dirty word to a certain swath of the political spectrum here in the United States. So persuade me that regulation is really the way for innovation to be enhanced. And also politically, how do we get to that place?
Well, the difficulty right now is that, as you said, the go-to defense for the companies is, well, China doesn't do that. So if you do that to us, we'll be in a competitive disadvantage. And so, you know, Bobby's mother lets him do that. Never was an excuse that worked with my parents, and I'm not sure it should work in a policy environment either. What we need to have, however, and you just put your finger on a key thing, Margaret, we need to rethink what regulation is. You know, in the paper, I talk about oversight. I try to avoid using the R word. And I think that we need to have a new structure of oversight. Our current oversight scheme was designed in the industrial era to deal with industrial realities, and we adopted the style of industrial management. What is that style? That is a top-down, rules-based, bureaucratic structure. Nobody runs their companies that way anymore. Agile management is the watchword. Diffusing authority and responsibility is the structure. How do we bring that into the 21st century and oversight of the markets? Because we don't walk away from oversight, but at the same point in time, we don't have to utilize the old models just because that's what we've always done. And in the paper, I talk, for instance, about the open banking initiative in the UK, where the UK said to its 9 largest banks, you're holding all of this data on your customers. You freeze it. You create a bottleneck so others can't get to it. You need to open that up so that there can be innovative uses of that data that may, in fact, create new competition for you. And here's how you're going to do it, is that you, the banks, are going to come up with a set of rules that open up the data, and we will have supervision of those activities. So it is a new regulatory structure. Excuse me, oversight structure, if you will, which is a collective working together to accomplish a goal. And it's been wildly successful. There have been 200 companies that have accessed that open data to offer new and innovative services to consumers. And it is that kind of innovation that we want to be encouraging in the United States if we're ever going to be able to deal with the centralized control of China.
Nicole, you are going to get the last word.
So I think, you know, I think that any type of imposition of regulation, particularly in this very partisan climate, is somewhat dangerous and runs the risk of stalling, I think, the type of progress that we need to make around new technology. And so I actually think that the concept of oversight is interesting, but I do think we need to shy away from pushing, you know, round pegs into square holes, only because, you know, we're looking at a communications regulation that was based on the telegraph, and every iteration of regulatory debate has involved trying to stick with those outdated and restrictive regulations for something that is entirely new and unknown. And so I do agree that there are models that exist when it comes to oversight, and we can do a much better job of that. In fact, some of the work I'm doing right now is around machine learning algorithms and what can we do in that space to not impose any more regulatory restrictions. But I think we need to be very careful, because that's not going to happen in this Congress. And it's not going to happen anytime soon as we pivot potentially to new presidential leadership.
But that's not a reason, Nicole, excuse my interruption. That is not a reason not to try and step up. Oh my goodness, I may lose the game is not a reason not to suit up.
It's not a reason, but it's an age-old debate, Tom. It's a decades-old debate that's gotten us into the same place. That's why we don't have federal privacy legislation right now. That's why we're still trying to catch up on the infrastructure planning. And I think one of the things that this pandemic has shown us, and I can give you a perfect example when it comes to the regulatory restrictions that were placed on telehealth. We have fought for over two decades to have the ability for people to do remote healthcare. And we've had the same type of regulatory restrictions and burdens in terms of licensing, reimbursements, as well as other interstate compliance issues. And now we've actually waived those with HHS. And what we're seeing is that people have this ability to actually take advantage of telehealth while keeping others healthy and at the same time reducing the burdensome workload on our hospitals and medical care providers. That's decades.
You're absolutely right.
Discussion. And now, look, we've opened it up. So I am in no way like disagreeing with you that I think we have to have different conversations on what oversight looks like. And we may have to think very creatively on how we regulate something that should be more future-proof, right? Because the nature of this industry continues to change. I personally think that we have now collected enough data to be able to tell us what works and what doesn't work. But I think most importantly, if we're going to look at regulation, and this is one area I'd like to leave in terms of my final word, this is not a us against them phenomenon. It should not be something that is polarizing, you know, big tech versus small tech, big companies versus small companies, individuals versus government. This is an area now that has proven itself to be worthy of a long-term conversation on how the U.S. will benefit from this, and not just certain actors, but everybody. And so I leave with this. I think if we were to take this conversation to the next Margaret podcast, podcast, we should be talking about what the future of innovation looks like generally. And in the absence of a coordinated plan, I think we're going to continue, Tom, to have these same types of conversations. So I think it's just really important for the purposes of both of our work to see how we can actually marry what our goals and aspirations are for infrastructure with what our goals and aspirations are for the use of the data economy to make America at the epicenter of a lot of that conversation versus having us either catch up, compare, or try to figure out ways to calibrate a strategy that's just not going to work under the current regulatory climate.
And we'll have to leave it there. Tom and Nicole, thank you so much for coming on the Lawfare podcast.
Oh, thank you,
Margaret.
Thanks for having us.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Links to the papers we talked about can be found on this episode's show page and the Brookings website. If you haven't yet, please take a second to share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can also now purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.